2014, and this is the Hermetic Hour with host Poke Runyon. And tonight we present a discussion on the 21st path of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, leading from Netzach up to Heset. Now this is the path attributed to Jupiter, and the Hebrew letter Kaf, which represents the hand, and the Tarot trump, the Wheel of Fortune. Now the Sphere of Heset is also attributed to the planet Jupiter, making this a very powerful, positive combination. And we have a unique interpretation of the Wheel of Fortune, which also appears in our Crater Ripoa initiatory system. Heset, Jupiter, is appropriately ruled by the Phoenician father god El, spelled Elephomed. And we place the Phoenician god Dagon in residence there. Heset also relates to Atlantis as the ruling realm of the mythical world. So, if you want to go back in time with us and meet an amphibious ancient astronaut, tune in and make the journey with us. Now, before we get started here, I want to make a couple of announcements of things coming up. On February 15th at 7 p.m. in Austin, Texas, our own Frater Heracles will be presenting a lecture in cooperation with Austin's SOMA, Society of Magical Artists. This is an evening with John Sheffield, Master of the Ordo Templi Astartes Austin Hermitage, discussing the OTA's Solomonic Magic. And if you are in Austin, Texas, in that area, and you'd like to attend this opportunity to learn about the OTA and its growing new lodge in Austin, please contact SOMA, S-O-M-A, at their website. Now, this is www.austinsoma.com, or email them at info@austinsoma.com for location and details. And also, SOMA has a Facebook page at www.facebook.com/groups/austinsoma. Now, this is not something that you want to miss if you're in that area, and you also want to check out the resources on the Internet. I'll go over those again so you're sure you got them. The website for SOMA is www.austinsoma.com. The email for them is info@austinsoma.com. And the Facebook page for them is www.com/groups/austinsoma. Now, along with that, next week, or here on the Hermetic Hour, we are going to have the people from SOMA in Austin calling in, and they're going to talk about what they're doing and what the occult community in the Austin area is up to. And so next week's show will be having SOMA on board with us. So let's be sure we support our local Austin people. You know, they got a sign outside of Austin. Keep Austin weird. I guess Austin is the place in Texas where you can get kind of weird. we've been down there, and I'll tell you they're down there all right. We went to the Spider House. Oh boy, that was cool, man. I tell you, it almost felt like going back to the 1970s again. So that's what's going on in Austin, and Frater Heracles is doing a great job down there. Now, tonight we're doing the 21st path. And This is quite special for us, and I'm going to go over the correspondences. I use John Greer's Paths of Wisdom book here, so we could go over the correspondences of the path just to get the technical details out of the way here. Oh, the letter for the path is Kaf, and it represents the hand. The name of God is Reflamed El. That just means God, and of course that represents that, you know, he was God a long time before Yahweh came along, and still is God, and he was probably the God. He was the God of the 10 so-called lost tribes of Israel. Actually, they were never lost. they just stayed there when the Yahweh worshippers were hauled off to Babylon, and that was only two tribes and a few Levites. El is the original God. And, you know, he's still a pretty nice guy, actually. He was always called El the Compassionate. The only thing he ever did wrong, I mean, or be criticized for, was going down one time down to, on Earth and finding a couple of young ladies skinny dipping on the beach, and he cooked them a chicken and had his way with them. But that's not the only thing he ever did that was reprehensible. And I'm not even sure that was reprehensible. I think that's pretty good, actually. He shared equal duties and powers with Lady Asherah of the Sea. And he certainly, you know, that was better than Yahweh, who was a bachelor, you know, and kind of a curmudgeon, you know, jealous, whatever. Anyway, so El is the God of the path, and also happens to be the God of the sphere. And the sphere is a said. The sphere represents Jupiter, which is the largest planet in the solar system. And don't ever let anybody tell you that the Kabbalah is not astrological and planetary, because it is. And if you don't think so, just invest in Ramberg's 23-volume set of the Zohar, and you will find out that there's a lot of astrology and a lot of planetary symbolism in the spheres in the Kabbalah. And Jupiter is certainly the right planetary reference for his set, which is the first of the spheres below the abyss. It's the first sphere that manifests in the physical universe, because above that, Saturn is where the physical universe gets started, you know, and that's, well, we put Da'at there, but in the 11th sphere tree, but in the 10th sphere tree, it's Saturn, but it's across the abyss. So with that, the path we have, 21st path, is also related to Jupiter. And, you know, a lot of these paths are not really related to the same planets that the spheres are related to. But in this case, the path and the sphere are both related to Jupiter. Now, the tarot correspondence is trumped in the Wheel of Fortune. Now, most people think of the Wheel of Fortune as just that. You know, spin the wheel and hope that when it stops that you got the number, that you're on the number. But
I remember Jack Benny, the old Jack Benny, shows you how old I am. The old Jack Benny radio program we had, they would go over to Las Vegas and they had this wheel, this roulette wheel, and they'd spin it and he'd hear it going around. Then somebody would put the brakes on, you know. It would stop. But that's a rather mundane interpretation of the Wheel of Fortune. The Wheel of Fortune, at least in our philosophy, the Wheel of Fortune has a great deal more significance. And the significance is, I think, rather profound. And we're going to get into that when we get into the path working here. Now, the path text, the 21st path, is called the Intelligence of Conciliation.
And it's so called because it receives the divine influence which flows into it from its benediction upon all and each existence. That's kind of formal. Now, the mythological principle is aspiration. And the experiences of the path, and this is according to what John has here, flight or views from a high place, journeys among or up the mountains, brilliant light, often rainbow-colored, emotional exhilaration. The entities on the path, pilgrims journeying, eagles, and other winged. That's very accurate. Now, magical images. An arch of clear violet bearing the letter Kaf in brilliant white on its keystone. The door in the arch bears the image of the trump. And that, of course, is the Wheel of Fortune. Now, colors in absolute, violet, timbria, blue, and that's what it is in the Minuta Mundum blue. In Yadzura, rich purple. In Ashia, bright blue, rayed with yellow. Now, that gives us, and you know, this path, if you're visualizing the Tree of Life, or if you happen to have one in front of you now, if you're familiar enough with it to be able to close your eyes and see it, or keep your eyes open and look up and see it, here's Netzach down here, nice green Netzach, sphere number 7, attributed to Venus, sphere of nature, and the sphere of, we have a call. You're on the Hermetic Hour. Who am I speaking with?
Hey, Boak, it's Frater Solomon.
Wow, welcome back, Frater Solomon.
Yeah.
I understand Saturday night we're gonna do one of your fabulous Merkaba chariot ascension operations, right?
Well, I guess there's some people calling for that, so yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm figuring out exactly what would be the best one to do. Probably the Angel of the First Palace would be a good place to start.
Well, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Now, let me go ahead and get going on this, setting up this path here, and then when I get this set up, we'll get back to you. Hang on, we'll get back to you for your comments. We're going, basically, with this path, we're going up the Pillar of Mercy. You know, that's on the right side of the tree as you look at it. And the Pillar of Mercy, we're going straight on up, and we're going from Netzach up to Hesed. And when we're crossing the, in doing this, we're crossing the veil of the sanctuary, and this is, as those of you who have been following our pathworking session, this is a boat working. Now, what I mean by that is we're going to take off. We're not going to have to walk or take the dolphin boat and go across the ocean all the way up to. Up to the Isle of Netzach, the way we would do, we're going to fly over it. We're going to fly over the reef and over the sea and over the Isle of the Dark Mother and all of that. And we're going to get to the Temple of Venus, which is Netzach. And of course, as you folks remember, especially you associate members who have our pathworking DVD, and if you're an associate member and you don't have our pathworking DVD, well, you know, come on now. I'll ask you with the program. But anyway, the Temple of Venus, as we envision it in Netzach, is as the temple, and it is a pool of living water, and the goddess sits in it, the goddess Astarte, and she's visualized as 50 feet tall, and she's sitting in a pool of living water. She's translucent, and all of her chakras are visible. And of course, she represents the whole physical universe. And that path involves your experience in her Psychic Centers, which is a sort of an inside-outside miniature and giant experience, magical experience, because she represents the whole universe. Now, we're going to, of course, fly in Kusor's boat, which spreads its wings, and we get on in the Temple of Malkuth, and we fly over the seascape and the islands and all of that the Bath of Koth, and we go all over that, and then we land at the Isle of Venus. Well, we don't go through the whole business again. We just land there, and then we prepare to take off on the path on Path 21. And what we're going to do then is we're going to take off and fly to another island on the way to up to Hesed. And I'm just going to go ahead and read this from our path working script. Now, by the way, this script is not, this is an advanced path working, and it's not in your DVD. So you're getting some material that's not secret stuff, okay? So listen carefully. Now, our wing boat circles down and lands on a barren island. We disembark and make our way to the top of the highest crag, and here we discover a very unusual feature. Looming before us, crowning the summit, rises a freestanding megalithic stone arch, and the two massive stone uprights are set very close together, too close for a human body to pass through. And we realize that this is some sort of ancient sighting device. And the letter Koth is carved on the lintel stone far above our heads. Now, looking out at the endless sweep of the nighted horizon, we see the vast star-scattered vault of the heavens etched more clearly than we have ever beheld it before, and the constellations of the zodiac are clearly visible, and as we study them, we can even see the faint outlines of the mythological figures traced between the stars. And this is the great 12-spoke wheel of death and rebirth, the mighty clock face of eternity. Pisces now lies just on the horizon, as seen through the sighting slot in the megaliths. And suddenly there's a flash of light, a sunrise at vernal equinox, and the great wheel rolls backward, bringing Aries into the position it occupied over 1,000 years earlier. Another flash, another sunrise, and the wheel rolls again, sliding back to bring Taurus into position as it was 3,000 BC. Another flash, and Gemini rolls back. Flash again, and Cancer. Now, I'm going to skip over here because I don't, like I said, this is kind of secret material here, so I don't want to give it all away. Now, we end up looking out at the sky 21,000 years ago. Now, we return to our boat, and we climb aboard. Now, 21,000 years is significant to that. I'm not going to get into it right now. We return to our boat, and we climb aboard, and the boat spreads its wings and flies out into the sunrise. And as the beautiful dawn spreads its light over the ocean below, we see a vast island continent on the horizon. And as we approach this landmass, we see the distant shimmer of a great city on the seacoast. The rising sun reflects off domes sheathed in ruddy metal and surmounted with dazzling crystals. The city is laid out in a series of concentric rings, which we see are actually water-filled canals, over which four great causeways form an equivalent cross, like the arms of a compass rose. Great towered bridges rise at the north, south, east, and west gates of the city. Now I'm going to stop reading from the script because I don't want to give away this material completely. But anyway, this is obviously a description of very ancient Atlantis. Now, Atlantis, aside from being what some people would consider an Evening Isle fantastical, Atlantis is also a very, very important part of Western esoteric mythology and Western esoteric and the Western esoteric tradition. And that's not in the theosophical end of things either. That's the Western esoteric tradition. And Plato wasn't the only one who wrote about it. Diodorus and others also wrote about it. Proto Solomon, you want to talk about some of the sources of Atlantis and all of that? Let's hear some more evidence about this.
Well, one of the forgotten texts that really helps key in on Atlantis and gives a lot of its history is Diodorus Siculus. And he places Atlantis, he doesn't really talk about the island of Atlantis too much, but he talks about, we have the Atlas Mountains in pretty much where Morocco is. So that would have been kind of the eastern part of the Atlantean Empire when they had their island, who knows where. You make a good argument for the coastal area around the British Isles. And one thing that's really neat, if you take the Babylonian history, you superimpose it with Sankuniathon and Diodorus Siculus, you get kind of a clear picture. The original father of everybody is a guy named Zeus Hypsistos, according to Sankuniathon. That's his Greek name, but it's his Phoenician name was El Elyon, which is our good old father El. So you have El, you've got Zeus, who's obviously the Greek name of Jupiter. So our correspondence is really good for El Elyon, and then you have the old Alalu. He's really a very, very old Jupiter deity, and there's Sankuniathon makes a younger Zeus. But the interesting thing is El's son, he has a son named Atlas, who, of course, he's got actually a grandson named Atlas and a son named Uranus, who he also equates sort of with Poseidon. So you have the first Atlantean king is actually the son of the first Phoenician king, good old compassionate El or Zeus Hypsistos, which is kind of neat because it makes the whole Phoenician Empire a lot more ancient. If we take Philo at his word that Sankuniathon was really an old source, and I believe there's a good evidence for it. Just because
you're right about that. Sankuniathon has been upgraded considerably. I found out something. One of the reasons why Sankuniathon was not taken as seriously as he is now is because back in about 1830, somebody perpetrated a Phoenician hoax and supposedly came up with a manuscript that was supposedly written by or directly copied from a manuscript that was written by he claimed Sankuniathon, and for a while that hoax was accepted as the real thing, and when it was debunked, then the real Sankuniathon, which we don't really have. All we have is a summary by a later writer of Sankuniathon. So that came into question. But now, with all of the research that's been done since World War II, especially the Ugarit discoveries, all we realize that Sankuniathon was probably pretty close to the mark, the summary that we have, and he probably was around about the time of King Solomon, not later. And but the important thing about Atlantis here is, and in relation to an ascent to Jupiter, and has said, and that ruling position, that imperial position in the Tree of Life, is that Atlantis is the holy city of the Western esoteric tradition in the Hermetic sense. Now, in the Christian sense, you'd say the holy city, of course, is Jerusalem. You know, both the heavenly Jerusalem. That's the holy city for the Christians, you could say that some people would say that the holy city for the Hermetic tradition is Heliopolis in Egypt, but in modern Hermetic mythology or modern Hermetic legend, we consider Atlantis to be be our mythological city, like Petelmont in the Parseval and Shambhala in the Buddhist tradition and all. We consider Atlantis to be that center. And Atlantis, it as we said in as Philo said in Beyond Lemuria, you said it perfectly replicates the celestial sphere when seen from above. You know, when you're looking down on the celestial sphere, the map of Atlantis perfectly replicates it. And so what you have here is a city that has a astrological symbolism, and it has mythological symbolism. And what we conceive, because in our Phoenician tradition, we place, although El is the ruling god, for appropriately applied to Hesed, we place the Phoenician and Philistine god Dagon, who is the father of Baal, by the way, we place him in Hesed. Now, we also conceive of Dagon, and this is this conception is, you know, some people don't go along with it, but we conceive of Dagon as amphibious. We equate him with Awanus, the fish man who was the great teacher of the Sumerians. We equate him with the sign of Capricorn, the fish goat. We equate him with Vishnu and his amphibious configuration, and we also equate him with the Dogon's Omo, the beings from Sirius, and who came down at a very early time, and also became, which is replicated in the Ioannis legend, and so Dagon is in our tradition is visualized as a very wise extraterrestrial amphibian who we like to think of as being a resident of Atlantis, and we place him in a temple, in the temple in the center of Atlantis, in his tank, and he's the last of his kind, and he tells us when we go there and do the path working. And he also dwells, of course, in our psychic center, in our third eye set psychic center. We have him there, and he represents a cosmic perspective. He represents cosmic wisdom. And he explains to us that he's the last of his kind, and that when he passes on, he and his brothers and sisters who came with him, they have no place to go. Their planet's gone, and so they reincarnate. And when they reincarnate, and that was 21,000 years ago, and they reincarnate in us. And so we have these Dagons reincarnated in us, and so we have him up there in our psychic center. And so we when we get to the path, we get to Atlantis, we get into the temple, we are able to make our first contact with Dagon and receive his knowledge and his wisdom. Now that's that's the way we do it. Now, also, too, as you know, our concept of the Wheel of Fortune is, as I started to describe it, it's similar to the Buddhist Wheel of Life. It's the zodiac. It's the eternal clock face, and we can use it. Yeah, very much like H.G. Wells' Time Machine. We can roll it backwards and roll it forwards, but the main purpose in this case is to use it to get back to Atlantis. Any more comment on that, Frater Solomon?
Well, I think it's neat because reincarnation is really it's how we reconnect with who we were. We also have the Great Year, which I think it lasts about a total of 25,000 years. And since Atlantis sank a bit over 10,000 years ago, that means this wheel, this Great Year, it started on Atlantis, and that might that would also bring in Melkart. That would mean Melkart, with his is sort of the initiator of it, was the one who initiated this wheel, perhaps on Atlantis.
Let me just say this: Melkart, which is the god of the city. It means the god of the city. And the city, of course, was Tyre. And the Temple of Tyre, Temple of Melkart in Tyre, the whole city was conquered, and 5,000 Phoenicians were crucified because they wouldn't let Alexander the Great come into the temple. and the reason why, because that was the big, that was their big secret, that the Phoenicians, and that was the connection, that was their connection to Atlantis and their connection to this 22,000-year-old zodiac. Like we say, that we know that the zodiac started about 4,000-some years ago, Taurus, with Aldebaran, when Aldebaran is at vernal equinox in Taurus. That's the beginning. That's called bullseye astrology. That's the beginning of the zodiac. But actually, we're saying, and we believe, that it's really not the last age of Taurus. It was the age of Taurus all the way around before that, not 4,250-some years ago. It was 22,000-something years ago. In order to fully understand this, you ought to look at Hamlet's Mill by De Santa Anna and von Decken and realize that the zodiac, we think, is a great deal older than is otherwise thought. You want to comment on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, we know it's Babylonian in origin, and we know the interesting thing is when you read the story of Hercules, and the funny thing is the older Greek legends, they have two Hercules, not one Hercules, and the Greeks had a tendency to take their gods and just kind of mesh them together. So Hercules was a combination of Hersaphnes and the older Hersaphnes, where he was a ram-headed god, so basically he's starting the zodiac at Aries, but you have Melkart, and he's kind of like Mithras, and slew the bull, and that's an older deity, and he starts it in Taurus, which puts us back further. So we have these cycles, and they go back further than we think. And the interesting thing is, it's like Pope mentioned with Sankunaiathon. There's the more we study these things, the more we realize there's a whole ancient heritage. And when you think that before the Ice Age, you have a planet, they've reconstructed it. There was several miles more of land, and it only takes a couple miles to build a city. And if you're going to build a city, and you're not aware that, okay, the Ice Age is going to come and, you know, it's going to end and all the shores are going to be flooded, that means there were probably hundreds of cities dotting the coasts of the whole Mediterranean, where you had a good temperature. You probably had tons of cities on the seashore that are all gone now. And we haven't found them yet because we really haven't made the technology to dig up all this dirt and see what's underneath them because it's covered with so much water. But in time, you know, we found Easter Island. We found that we've gone down a little bit further, and we realized, okay, there was something here before the flooding made the island smaller. So we would know just looking at it that there's a really old culture here. We just haven't been able to discover it. And just because we haven't been able to discover it doesn't mean it wasn't there. We have the clues from Plato and Diodorus that there was indeed a very ancient culture along the whole Mediterranean that would have been centered. We do have enough genealogical or geological, archaeological evidence in the Levant, that's Phoenicia, I guess we'll call it Canaan.
The truth is, Prior Solomon, the truth is, I'll wave my master's in cultural anthropology around a little bit here, because I want to make sure that people realize that we're not just talking New Age baloney here. The truth of the matter is this: that megalithic Cyclopean, was it Cyclopean or Cyclopean architecture?
Cyclopean? Yeah.
I think it's Cyclopean because who ever heard of a Cyclopes?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's more greatly accurate to say Cyclopean.
Some intellectual corrected me one time and said, "Hey, it's not Cyclopean, it's Cyclopean." And whereupon I said, "Well, yes, didn't Homer write about a Cyclopes?" But anyway, Cyclopean architecture, got those huge, gigantic, rough stones, I mean, that are so big that you just can't conceive how anybody can even move them. That architecture actually goes older. It gets older and it gets more prominent the further west you get. And as you go down toward the coast in Spain and in France, those chamber tombs get older and there's more of them. And the Hypogeum on Malta is so old, they know it's at least, 10,000 years old and probably older. So the evidence, the actual evidence for this very, very, advanced. Let's say very powerful, dynamic ancient civilization. The evidence for it gets older and more impressive as the further west you go. And I just read in this very, very excellent book by Sanford Holst called Secrets of the Phoenicians that he says the Phoenicians brought architects from Malta, Europeans, architects from Malta, to Egypt to build not pyramid, the step pyramid of Djoser. And he says that was built by European architects that were brought by the Phoenicians in their ocean-going ships to Egypt from Malta. Now, if that isn't proof that there was an Atlantean civilization out there past the around the Pillars of Hercules, because of course Diodorus says they were right around, they were on the African coast. They probably were, the Atlas Mountains area, like Diodorus says, and in Spain. And we found, Tarsus? What about Tartessos? This mysterious city Tartessos sunk in the alluvial plain on the western coast of Spain. And now they found another one that's even older, that's laid out on the same pattern as Atlantis, that circular clockwork, that circular pattern that looks like a gun sight. And that's buried beneath 20 feet of silt right north of Tartessos. And Tartessos is at least 5,000, well, more than that, 5,000 or 6,000 years old. And this one right up from Tartessos is even older and even bigger. And, of course, it's under 20 feet of mud, so it's going to be very, very difficult to get. But there's all sorts of relics in Spain that go back to this antediluvian period. Now, like we said, the sea level back 12,000 years ago, the sea level was 150 to 200 feet lower along the coast of Europe, western coast,
than it is today, which means that the seacoast, as you're saying, was this coastal villages and coastal towns are under 150, 200 feet of water. Now something else, too, that we want to mention here, and this is not New Age hoopla, this is anthropological truth. You don't need agriculture to have civilization. What you need is a steady food supply at a single point. That's all you need. And Atlantis had a really beautiful salmon run. I think this is one of the reasons why we call salmon the fish of the wise, the food of the wise. And we know that the Cro-Magnons, 30,000 years ago, salmon was one of their staple diets. And they were right down there. And they are basically modern human beings. And they were the progenitors of the Atlantean civilization. And these people, if you saw them today, one of the things I'm really upset about was that really nice, otherwise really great film, 10,000 BC. I don't know, many of us have seen it. But this was the Cro-Magnons 10,000 years ago, the mammoth hunters, coming down from Ice Age Europe all the way down into Egypt and running into the decadent Atlanteans down in Egypt. The film is very good, except for one thing. The Cro-Magnons up in Europe they're wearing animal skins. They look like alley-oop cavemen, and they're wearing tailored animal skins and putting sheep fat in their hair and bones in their noses, and they look like Stone Age, our idea of Stone Age savages. Actually, those mammoth hunters, those people, those Cro-Magnon people, wore tailored deerskin clothes. They looked like Iroquois. They looked like Iroquois Indians about 1730 period. And the Iroquois Indians on the East Coast, as you probably know, were a pretty darn civilized bunch of people. So that's what the Cro-Magnons really looked like at that time. And that's why 10,000 BC that fell. Otherwise, the Atlanteans, the way they picture them, this is great and everything. But Atlantis has come down to us, not just in Plato and Diodorus, but also Bacon, back in the Renaissance, used Atlantis as one of the as an allegory to create a utopia, and so we have it in our mythology, and it's one of our sacred cities. I don't want to sound like I'm trying to evangelize on this, but I do think that we ought to remove the stigma that frankly has been generated by Marxist archaeologists who don't want anything. They can't stand cyclical history. Cyclical history is an anathema to them. Everything has to evolve from the simple to the complex. And so Atlantis is a nasty word for them, and they don't want to hear it. I'm in kind of on my soapbox here. What thoughts do you have to add to this, Professor Solomon, or what do you think?
Well, I mean, we can look at the dinosaurs, and they were certainly much more spectacular than we are in a lot of ways, and a freak comet's what wiped them out. So really, I think it's fair to say the Atlanteans, same thing. They had an excellent coastal empire. They had a food supply. They didn't really have to work the agricultural system because they had plenty of fish, and they had all the crops that were right by the water. So there's not a need to work the land extra hard. They had everything they needed right on the seashore. And it was just a freak, it was kind of a freak accident. All of a sudden these polar caps melt and these beautiful, wondrous cities in probably hundreds just all of a sudden get wiped out and in a very short amount of time before anybody can do anything about it. And that's where we get our footage.
Actually, it wouldn't take a huge earthquake or a huge volcanic explosion like Farah, it wouldn't take that. All it would take, really, when you think about it, because they didn't realize that the sea level was going to rise the way it was, and so they would keep building dikes. And this is one of the reasons why maybe that circular pattern like that, maybe these were great big dikes, like Holland and like New Orleans, for heaven's sake. Katrina is a perfect example of what happened in New Orleans when Katrina is a perfect example of what may have happened to Poseidonis and Atlantis. Is they keep building these dikes, and because the sea level keeps rising, and they finally these dikes get really, really huge, and the sea level keeps rising, and then they have one big storm. That's all it takes. And down it goes. And this happened, Katrina's one example, but even more spectacular example than Katrina was the Netherlands back in the Renaissance. They had a huge storm, and two-thirds of Holland was flooded. Two-thirds of the country just went underwater. And in this case, in the case of Atlantis, the water kept rising. So once it was submerged, it kept on rising. And quite frankly, that whole area south of England is rather shallow. It's rather shallow out there. And they do bring up artifacts every so often. And then those earthworks, and prehistoric earthworks in southern England are just awesome. I mean, just absolutely awesome, some of those earthworks and chamber tombs and whatever. So the Atlantean maritime civilization, and it obviously was maritime, I think was certainly there and had an influence. And I think that the Phoenicians were the inheritors of it. I think they were the inheritors of it, and I think, and I suspect that the Atlanteans had something to do with the alphabet. And I have, you know, I really do. I suspect they had something to do with it. And I also suspect that the Phoenician alphabet was really one of the origins of the Kabbalah. Because you certainly can't do numerical, you can't very well do numerical analog off of cuneiform or off of hieroglyphics. Doesn't work that well. You need an alphabet. And you need an alphabet that also relates to the zodiac, and in order to have Kabbalah, you need an alphabet that relates both to the elements and to the planets and to the zodiac and the signs of the zodiac. You need this, and all you have to do is add two letters to the Phoenician alphabet, and you've got it. Now, so what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the connection between Phoenician Atlantis, it's really strong and it's really obvious. And we know that those pillars of Hercules, they were it was a lot easier to cross from Spain to Africa back then than it is now. And I just realized it right now, since we're talking about Britain as a potential source of Atlantis, Stonehenge was actually the centerpiece of a concentric city. So this idea of you have a center of the city and then you start building circles around it is a pattern that's actually repeated as far north as England, and it's Troy follows the same pattern. You mentioned just north of Tartessos, that pattern of this magical circle, and we've got it laid out. You can actually superimpose the Phoenician alphabet on it. It shows that has it's a very ancient system with a very ancient root, and using the circle in certain patterns, you can come up with a magical alphabet that sort of will allow you to navigate through the city. Just like we have three
Carthage,
names like
Carthage, you know, Carthage, which Rome moved heaven and earth to destroy. Carthage, the harbor was laid out just like Atlantis, just like Poseidonis. The same pattern, and the same thing with Tartessos, and the same thing with that city, that more ancient city north of Tartessos. This pattern this pattern of it repeats itself over and over again. Yeah. Yeah.
I never thought of today before Stonehenge. That's just that's amazing.
Yep, and Stonehenge repeats the pattern too. And the pattern is the zodiac, is the universe. It's why, as I say, it looks like if you take the Tropic of Cancer, and you take the North Pole, right, and then you look down at the celestial sphere from above, directly above, and it's bordered by the equator. And then you got the Tropic of Cancer, and then you have the inner Arctic Circle, and then you bisect it four times with two lines across, which give you the four seasons of the year. And what have you got? You got a perfect map of Poseidonis. Yep.
Boy, that really is perfect.
Oh yeah, it does, and that of course is our version of the Rose Cross, as you know, and the Heliosphere fits right into it, and that comes from supposedly from Cagliostro and from the crater Apollo. Anyway, I want to go over this announcement about next week again, and let's see now, Thursday, February 13th, the Hermetic Hour. The Society of Magical Artists in Austin at SOMA, and that's not a mushroom club, at least I don't think it is. Anyway, Society of Magical Artists, and we'll have Messrs. Paxton Knight and Paul Rana and Jeff Contreras, and they will be calling in, and they are going to be calling in next week, and we're going to talk about things esoteric and magical in Austin, Texas. And so be sure and listen in next week for that. And meanwhile, have a good weekend and good magic.